You have quite a literary establishment in Boston, don't you?
Well, it's a very strange thing. I always thought that I really would not associate with writers or have them as friends, you know, because I think it gets very cliquish and literati. And I find that, as Hilary Wall once said to me, you know, nobody in the world knows what it is you do, except for another writer. And when you're talking with a writer and dealing with a writer, it's in his eyes that, you know, we know what we do when we get up in the morning. And with these people, we never talk about writing. We talk about baseball and kids and dogs and so forth, and yet I find this, it's comfortable dealing with them, because with other writers, that look is not in their eyes of, you know, what really is it that you do? It's a help.
You started out as a journalist.
Well, no. Actually, I wrote Running Scared when I was about 23. And that book came out in 1964, and it was, as you know, I don't know if the critics have referred to it as the first shot fired in the Cultural Revolution. You know, it was people standing up and saying, we're not computer punch cards. And shortly thereafter, you know, we were married and making babies, and the weekly paycheck was essential. And I did go work at the Globe for really a spectacular 7 years. It was, you know, this side of the century, it was probably the most marvelous 7 years to be being a journalist. It was almost too much fun to be able to go anywhere at any time and ask anybody any damn fool thing you wanted to. It was a fantastic education.
Yeah, the bio said you had kind of an unusual job there. But was it, did your own assignments? You selected your own stories?
Yeah, essentially, that's what it came down to.
Reporter at large.
The Globe administrators were wise up to the fact that there was a story going on the streets which wasn't being covered. It was, you know, originally the Civil Rights Movement and the anti-war movement. It was the whole new arts, new music, new everything. And they did the thing of taking me, who had written a novel successfully, and their actual instructions were, go out and have fun and write about it. And they end up cut and bleeding on the sidewalk called the Globe. You know, it's a liberal newspaper. So that was really what I was doing. I was going out, and I don't think there was probably a riot in this country that I wasn't in. And being able to go and ask anybody, from an artist to a politician to a protester to anybody, you know, what are you doing this for? What makes you tick? Why are you doing it? And bring that into the newspaper, it was sort of a new thing for them. And I left the Globe, what, 11 years ago, last April. And I'm aware that I'm still drawing on the experiences. I'm still, you know, I'm not, I never write explicitly of a character. But being able to go and ask people to see things and have those experiences is just an incredibly rich experience.
You were turning out novels during this 9 years with the Globe.
No, not at all. Not at all. I ended up my last 3 years here as the arts humanities editor and critic at large columnist, which means that I was in charge of the shop of critics. And when you're doing that for a Morning Globe, an Evening Globe, and a Sunday Globe, and you're writing at least three columns a week, you don't have mental room for anything else. Nothing was being written there except for the newspaper, and which is why, you know, I had to stop journalism and then pick up novel writing again.
Yeah, I was talking to William McPherson, who wrote very highly acclaimed for his novel called Testing the Current. He works for the Washington Post. He's on the editorial page now, but prior to that he had edited the book review. But he was saying that while he does consider himself a journalist, what he really wants to do is write fiction. I mean, if he could just quit and do that on a full-time basis, he would like to do it. But his... it took him about 6 years to write Testing the Current, and it's not a fast-moving mystery that you can turn out in a quicker amount of time, and he's doing a sequel follow-up to it, so it's unlikely that he'll ever be in a position to quit his newspaper job in order to do what he really wants to do.
It was a risk, Don. It was a heck of a risk. In fact, when I look back on it, I wonder how the heck we all had the courage to do it. I was married. We had two sons. And there was nothing behind us. There was no money at all. We were living in rented quarters. It was just, you know, the time when either I did it then and I took the risk then, or you don't do it. And I got to tell you that it was years before I was, I think, breathing normally. It was sheer terror. And I thought that, in fact, that I would just do it for 1 year, take this risk for 1 year, and then go back to journalism however I could, or whatever I could do to get an income. And by the end of that year, it was, you know, things were just on the edge enough that it was ridiculous to stop doing what I was doing. You know, it was not a great success within a year, but it was indicative that I should go on.
Was that the first Fletch book you were working on?
That's right.
1974.
That's right. That came
out. Tell me how that evolved. How did Fletch develop, and how did you create it?
Well, as you know, my daddy was a journalist, and for the last two or three years I was working at the Globe. I realized that somewhere here there was a character, maybe the blithe spirit of journalism, that I'd been hearing stories at the dining room table when I was a kid, and that we were sitting around the city room at 3 o'clock in the morning telling these stories again about some journalist who always worked for the other newspaper, who you know, did things like phone in the desk and report the story of a murder and wind up by saying, you know, please ask the photographers to wait outside in the bushes until the widow gets home and discovers the body, you know, this sort of thing. And thus came along this character Fletcher. As you know, a Fletcher is an arrow maker. And he is maybe that blithe spirit of journalism. And of course, both he and Flynn couldn't have existed 15 years ago or 20 years ago. They are both, you know, totally post-revolutionary characters. They have a whole new regard for, in way of dealing with such things as authority, such things as women. They have a new way of looking at the world, which is really quite contemporary, I think.
You should probably establish the fact that Flynn began as a character in a Fletch novel.
Flynn began in the second Fletch novel, in Confess Fletch. He just appeared. And I was greatly taken by him. And when I was done with the with that book, I discussed with my then agent and my then editor publisher, this is a pretty interesting guy. Should we think of giving him his own book? And they said, oh, no way. He describes himself as being north of 40. He's married. He has kids. He loves his wife and kids. I mean, where's the romantic interest? Where's the sex? Where's the this? So, having been sternly advised against doing it, you know, I won't do a book unless there's a risk involved somewhere. I did it, and I gave it to them, and I guess the first night the manuscript was in the publisher's office, the head of marketing or sales or whatever took it off his desk and brought it home with him, and the next morning he came back in and dropped the manuscript on the publisher's desk saying, thank God, finally the SOB has done a book for me. which really set things up nicely. It, you know, he saw the value and the virtue of it, and it is very amazing. Nobody expected Flynn to be as successful as he is, but people who are still concerned with things like family and growing things and flowers and bushes and trees and dogs and cats and kids really seem to dig him.
Hangles. I edit this, so it does not run in the same form.
Okay.
So that's why. This expression that Flynn uses, I
kind of wondered about it. He says, I guess.
Yeah.
Why does he say that? I mean, how did that develop?
Well, Flynn, of course, was born in Ireland, and the story is that his father was the Irish consul in Germany during World War II. As you remember, Ireland was neutral.
And just barely.
Just barely. And that's the story, that Flynn, as a little boy in Ireland, was actually sort of being a spy. And writing his old school chum back in Dublin, and the letters were being passed over to the British Secret Service, so that Flynn actually was brought up partly in Germany. This is something about the Flynn character that I think is terribly important, and I had to think out before I wrote Flynn. I find that there is a new kind of person again in this part of the century. People who are doing their workaday jobs and yet who have an incredibly wide background. People who are working in insurance or farms or something and actually can sit down and describe to you streets in Singapore or in Lima, Peru, who have done fantastic things and got terribly wide experience because of the history of the world as it has been this last generation. And they are doing these simple jobs, and yet bringing to their jobs all kinds of interesting, deep, profound perspectives and experiences, which is making for a whole new kind of citizen. Flynn is that sort of person, which is, I think, another reason why people are responding to him in such a big way. You know, in one of the scenes, I think it's in The Black Pass is Flynn. Flynn is in a roadside diner with a pretty girl in Texas. And there's a motorcycle gang down the counter, and they're glowering at him, and they're staring at him, and so forth. And, you know, I am setting the reader up for the expectation that these are tough guys who are going to come along. And as Flynn and the girl are getting out to go, these motorcyclists come up to him and say, "Are you from Ireland?" And he says yes, and then they begin start talking about the theater in Ireland. They start quoting Yeats. I mean, this is what I find in America. And I think this is something that's getting across through Flynn, again, sort of contemporary.
Well, we talked about locale, you talked about Texas, and of course in Flynn's Inn, that's out in the country, in the hunting lodge. But one thing that I like are the Boston settings, because you get tired of Los Angeles, San Francisco, and New York all the time. You know, those three cities seem to be the most typical settings for novels. So I like the New England atmosphere. Because you've always been a New Englander, haven't you?
Yeah, I keep leaving it and I keep coming back to it. My wife has had the same experience of leaving and coming back. In fact, we had to go to Puerto Rico to meet each other. I think that Boston and New England in general has a certain ambiance. It's Boston is a unique city in this country. I don't know of any like it. I'm not saying uniquely good. I'm not saying uniquely bad, just unique. It's still a very ethnically divided city. It has a student transient population of something like 700,000 in the area, and that keeps the city very young and very vital and growing.
It's probably proportionally the city with the largest number of educational institutions.
Oh, it has to be. It has to be, which causes all kinds of tax problems, because actually the governments are trying to run up there with a very small tax base, which is why it's such an expensive place to live.
Do you live in Boston?
No, sir. We live about 30 miles out in near Walden Pond, in fact.
Mm-hmm. Where were you educated?
Well, I was educated at Harvard, class of 58. I was educated at Harvard. I was educated at sea. I was educated as a journalist. I'm still being educated. But my formal education was Harvard.
Mm-hmm. Well, Harvard certainly has a tremendous tradition of contributions to literature. As a matter of fact, I'm just doing a review of James Agee, a mm-hmm. new biography called James Agee by Lawrence Berggreen, and he's one person who comes to mind, but gosh, there's so many writers who have, Mark Halperin wrote The Winter's Tale, magnificent novel last year. Remember that? Did you read that one at all?
I did not read that at all.
Excellent. Well, it's different. It's a fantasy.
I'm certainly aware of a death in the family. My first book, Running Scared, was published by a brilliant small publisher named Ivan Obolensky, who, in something like a three-year career, published Running Scared, published Joan Didion's Run River, published Death in the Family, published Gingerbread Man, published Patton's, Amadeus Lothario Patton. Just an incredible list of things that he did. And then, to my great grief, went out of business. Mm-hmm. But boy, I think we're all very
what
grateful.
What was the name of the publisher?
Ivan Obolensky. I haven't seen him in, 20 years or whatever it's been, but I'm very grateful to that man.
Tell me about Running Scared. You said you were 24 when you wrote that.
Yes, sir. Well, I'll tell you about it. It's a book that has been published something like five different times in this country, and it just won't die. It's now old enough to vote. It's going to be reissued again, I think, next year by Warner's. It's a book dealing more or less with rational suicide among the young, and dealing with it seriously. It is not a thriller. It is not a mystery. It's a pretty somber book, which I find some people have found it helpful as a piece of fiction. As a matter of fact, I met a man a couple of years ago who said I should have written that and never written anything again.
Mm-hmm. How did it come about?
How did it come about? Well, as I say, I was at Harvard during the late 1950s. The computer was just coming to be, a major factor in our lives. There hasn't been much written about this, but the corporations were being run very heavily by people who had been senior military officers, and everything was rather crew cut and march forward, and people were being very highly regimented by the society that was. And it was very difficult to individuate yourself at that time and grow up and be your own person. It was a very heavily suppressed time. And, of course, it led to the great blow-off that was the late 1960s and early 70s. That was the rebellion against the things that we were talking about in Running Scared. And I do believe, Don, that we are coming back into an era very similar to that, in which the young people are again, settling down into a kind of regimentation, finding it very, very difficult again to individuate themselves. So that's what I came about.
I don't know if that's necessarily so bad. I remember the 60s is one of the ugliest, most turbulent decades in my lifetime.
An awful lot was accomplished during the 60s that needed to be accomplished. In the book, The Man Who, Fletch and the Man Who, I thought I was sort of stating what I thought should be the campaign of this election. It's not being. I don't know if there is an issue anywhere that I'm hearing in this campaign, but I'm very gently trying to say that the technological revolution is having as much an effect and as profound an effect upon us as individuals as the Industrial Revolution ever had. It is an overwhelming thing that is happening to us. We are being replaced by machines. There really is becoming a declining need for people in this world. And what are we going to do about it? What are we going to do with all these individuals? And how do people become people and remain as people in a totally technological world?
Well, that's not what happens, though. People don't really become obsolete as technology expands and develops. It endows additional technology, and it absorbs the people who may or have been threatened with being cast off. One form of industrial expansion creates another, and on, it just keeps expanding.
Well, that's the theory. But if you look at the figures, you'll see that West Germany right now is voting on knocking the work week down to 4 days to make more jobs. Can the human being actually stand taking 3 days a week off all of his life, all of her life? There is something very definitely going on here. You know, we are relating to each other electronically at this point. There is becoming a declining need to get up in the morning and go anywhere. You can get up in the morning and sit at your computer and really not relate to people and do your day's work. A huge percentage of our working force can now do this.
I would assume that is especially applicable to you. I mean, do you work at home?
I work at home, yeah.
So you could get up in the morning and not see anybody except your immediate family.
Absolutely right. And
is this a problem for you? Do you find this a problem? Or can you break away from this and establish relationships outside of the home very...
Oh, no, it's a great problem. It's an enormous problem. And one feels a little silly talking about it because it sounds so ideal. But especially after being a journalist and walking through 600 to 1,000 people a week and enjoying them and digging them and so forth, suddenly to be quietly at home in your study and you get... You know, you do 4 or 5 hours of intense work in the morning, and then there's nobody to play with, you know. The isolation is considerable.
Yes, and you don't have the opportunity to make the contacts and to renew them. I know that when I'm on vacation sometimes, I usually take it long, like, well, my next vacation will run about a month. And if we come back from wherever we've gone and I hang around the house for a week or 2 weeks... I see a couple of neighbors, perhaps, but I don't, unless I come in to get my paycheck or something like that, I don't see anybody. I find that I lose contact with people, and people forget about me. The phone stops ringing, and everything quiets down. Our relationships become very insular.
Very insular. We had an interesting thing happen. As you may remember, in 1978, we had a massive blizzard up there in the country where I live. And in fact, we weren't plowed out for something like 5 days. And I and my family enjoyed it enormously because we were all at home, and we loved cross-country skiing, and we were able to get out and go, you know, rescue some of the older ladies in the neighborhood and so forth. It was great fun for us. But at the end of it, we discovered that the divorce rate in our neighborhood jumped unbelievably. You know, it was the first time that Daddy had spent 5 days at home along with his wife and kids, and they all discovered they didn't like each other very much. I don't think human beings can stand this kind of thing, or if they must stand it, they've got to make some very, very heavy adjustments. We very shortly are coming to a society in which everybody is sitting in little electronic boxes and not really relating to each other as persons very much at all.
Yeah, we'll have to develop new ways of dealing with it. We haven't figured it out yet.
We've got to develop new ways of dealing with it, and it's we've got to have some guidance, and it's got to start coming pretty quickly. I mean, you know, I certainly think that the increasing percentage of our population which is going to drugs, I think this is a result of this new world of ours.
Now, I read about these women who work at home with a computer processing medical claims, insurance claims, and things like that. And that must be very tedious on the face of it anyway, but they have to do it at home. There's no one around except you have to take care of the baby or something like that. But, gosh, it must be terrible to try to concentrate in your home doing these numbers and forms. Oh, it must be awful.
It is strange that since I was born, the population has about doubled, which is an incredible thing by itself. And as the population is doubling, the technology is becoming so keen that, in fact, we're becoming increasingly isolated as individuals. It's a very strange irony. And it's something which has got to be addressed in a pretty serious manner pretty soon.
Well, Gregory MacDonald, the detective genre, are you going to pursue this in the years ahead?
I never meant to pursue it at all. When I wrote the book Fletch, I had absolutely no idea of carrying on or doing a sequel or whatever. And in fact, it was really getting a lot of letters saying, this is pretty great, let's, you know, may we have some more, please. And I have felt that, you know, as long as people want it, and as long as I can be fresh and be saying something thematically new in the Flynn books and the Fletch books, then I'll do it.
I
hope I will, you know, when I wear out my welcome, I'll have the sense to know it.
You'll know it. I understand, according to the biographical material here on you, that some movie versions are in the works. Is that right?
Yeah, I was out in California last week. They are filming Fletch. Universal Pictures is doing it, and Chevy Chase is playing Fletch. And it was really quite a mind-boggling thing to be out there, and I really had no function or role. I was really just being warmly hosted and playing with people and whatnot. It was great fun. Chevy Chase is a brilliant guy, and he's a terribly instinctively funny man. I mean, just one story. The last day I was on location with him, we were eating down in a park where they had set up the commissary at these long tables, and the young lady who was in the movie, Dana Wheeler Nicholson, was sitting beside me, and Chevy was sitting across from her. And we were eating watermelon, and Dana was taking the seeds out of her mouth one by one and putting them down on this paper plate in this most lovable, bird-like, lady-like fashion. And I was watching her out of the corner of the eye, just loving her and loving the way she was doing things. And Chevy saw me watching her with... And suddenly he jumped up and threw out his arms and said, "What? You don't want those pits?" I mean, you know, where does this come from? I mean, just this crazy humor that is so delightful.
Do you have any fears that the movie version will not turn out to be what you had anticipated or hoped?
Yes, of course. Sure I do. But I will say that this has to be done. If this isn't a very good picture indeed, then there really isn't much purpose to brightness and talent in this world. The people involved with it are just, it's the most remarkable group of people, I think, who have ever come together to make a picture. Michael Ritchie, the director, is brilliant. Both Chevy Chase and the screenwriter, Andrew Bergman, whom I've not met, clearly sat down and read the Fletch books and analyzed his character and analyzed his humor. And it's very hard to see on the set, and it's very hard to see looking at the daily rushes, but I believe Chevy Chase has caught Fletch's puckishness and, you know, is doing it very well. But nevertheless, you know, how they put it together and so forth is quite a whole different thing.
Well, Chevy needs a good movie. He's had a lot of mixed reviews of late. So I hope this is the one, and I'm certainly looking forward to seeing it. And I thought Flynn's Inn was a good read. I enjoyed it, and I wish you the best with it. When is the pub date, incidentally, or has it passed? The
pub date was May.
May?
Yeah, the book is out, and it's already sold fantastically
well.
May. Well-reviewed.
They just got it to me.
Did they really?
Yeah.
I'm sorry about that. Flynn's Inn is the kind of thing that I really enjoy doing. I mean, here, I don't mean to sound pompous, but, you know, the theme is elitism. And I try to write it in such a way, I think that we all know that in every town, in every school, in every college, in every work situation, that, you know, there are always the two or three same people who are going out to lunch together, who are drinking together on Friday night, who are playing golf or whatever it is on Saturday. And these people are making very profound decisions about us, our promotions, our demotions, what kind of chairs we sit in, our pension funds, and they're doing it without a heck of a lot of reference to us. There really is a thing in this world which is called elitism, and the question is, you know, what is it and how does it operate? And here we've got a humorous and playful novel, which I think is fun for people to read. And I had a great worry before it came out. Am I being pompous? Is this, you know, too heavy a theme for the genre or something? Will people recognize what it is I'm talking about? And I am extremely pleased that everybody, young, old, male, female, country, city, working, knows exactly what it is I'm saying. They're digging it, and they seem to be very happy that I'm, you know, that I took the risk with it and did this thing.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in and talking. It was certainly interesting, and I wish I'd had a chance to talk to you closer to the pub date, but the book is still on the bookshelves, right?
Oh, sure.
So,
sure.
This little broadcast is supposed to be heard on WEEI in Boston, so I don't know when they run it, but I hope it...
It's one of my favorite stations, so I'll pick it up.
Have you ever heard the BookBeat on EEI?
I have, indeed. I sure have. I'm
you know what time of day they run it? I've never been able... We have no control over the when they run it. But I heard... L.A., I've heard conflicting reports of it. Ran on the overnight, and then it ran during the afternoon, and so I'm never quite sure where
there was one been. Period, Don, in which I think it was running at some ridiculous night hour, and at that point I'm not a night person, and I stopped hearing you, and I that broke my habit, and I will have to investigate when
we run it three times a day here, and on the overnight as well as in the afternoon and in the evening,
mm-hmm.
So and on the weekends too. We save the piece, run it on the weekends. So. I try to hit. I'd love to get one more play, but lucky to get this. You're talking. This is a literary broadcast, and talking about books. We're talking about authors, and it's sometimes not easy to encourage people to want to listen or use it. So I try to make it as interesting as I can. Listen, thank you very much for coming in, and I certainly appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Don. It's been great fun.